Hi in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon, this is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. Today we'll be focusing on the hottest issue at hand, of course, and that is the threat to free speech, not just to the United States, but not just to any civil rights activists, not just to environmental activists, not just to Palestinian protesters, not just to the nation itself, but to the globe itself. And that's at the heart of that is that there are Zionist organizations like the Anti-Defamation League that are lobbying for that. And we saw that come to become a reality when the Anti-Defamation League stood shoulder to shoulder with the Trump administration, as the Trump administration sent ICE agents to abduct Muhammad Khalil, a peaceful Palestinian student activist at Columbia University. If just talking to you, DC, if you don't know that the buck stops here, if you're not fighting right now at the front line, and the front line is the liberation of Mahmoud Khalil, because if they break through that, then Marco Rubio will set an example for the dismantling of free speech in this nation. I guarantee you that's what's happening. When we said, now you're seeing Exhibit A, when we said that the Palestinian question is the litmus test for global justice, this is what's happening. This is the front line right now. So I have several things to share with you, and I'll introduce them one by one. Before I go into that, I just want to mention a couple of things. First of all, please find your community and start acting. Because action is working. The mass turnout in New York to defend Mahmoud Khalil was tremendous and impactful. And the fact that a federal judge was forced to stop the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil is pretty significant and proves to you that grassroots activism is not dead. Secondly, I wanted to say that you probably noticed that the Black Lives Matter sign is being removed with the complicity of our beloved mayor, who I can't believe people are writing to me that they're in disbelief that the mayor is agreeing with this. Who do you think the mayor is? The mayor is completely complicit with the Trump administration. The whole point of putting Black Lives Matter in front of the White House was a completely performative act while the mayor increased the police budget, and nothing had changed. You know, watch what she does, not what she says. Lastly, I want to introduce this short clip here. This is Simone Zimmerman, who's speaking at the 2025 conference of the Jewish left. And this is a week before the Anti-Defamation League stood shoulder to shoulder with the Trump administration as they sent ICE agents to abduct Mahmoud Khalil, as I mentioned earlier. So let's listen to Simone Zimmerman here.
Every other organization that collaborates with the Trump administration, whether because of their Israel politics or to have access to power, are threatening the future of all Americans, including American Jews, who believe in democracy and civil rights, and who reject Trump's movement and all it stands for. In order to maintain ironclad support for Israel, many American Jewish organizations deny not just the reality of the Nakba, but also the fact that this unjust, unequal, and oppressive reality endangers all who live between the river and the sea, Jewish and Palestinian alike. They work overtime to preserve an image of a moral and beleaguered Israel, to insist that calls for accountability are an existential threat, and to silence voices of dissent. And there is perhaps no organization more identified with this strategy than the Anti-Defamation League. The ADL says they're a neutral arbiter of anti-Semitism, no matter where it shows up, but that's not true. They have conflated the safety of Jews with support for the state of Israel. In so doing, they undermine their own stated mission of fighting anti-Semitism. How did this happen? Since the 70s, the ADL has sought to popularize the concept of the new anti-Semitism, the idea that Israel as the Jew on the world stage was being unfairly singled out for criticism in ways that echoed old-school anti-Semitism. And they have long worked to smear and discredit the movement for Palestinian freedom. In 2022, the organization escalated its campaign when their CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, declared Jewish Voice for Peace, Students for Justice in Palestine, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations the photo inverse of white nationalists. I believe this endangers Jews, to have leaders in our community so gravely cheapen the meaning of anti-Semitism. But if you don't believe me, believe their own staffers, who also find this position controversial and counterproductive. A senior staffer quit over Greenblatt's mishandling of anti-Semitism on X, his coddling up to Elon Musk as he let hate speech run rampant on the platform. Last year, The Guardian published leaked Slack messages where a senior manager at their Center on Extremism wrote that Greenblatt's comparison of anti-Zionists with white nationalists was intentionally dishonest and damaging to their reputation as experts in extremism. Others chimed in, agreeing that his false equivalencies were incompatible with the data. He didn't listen. When Greenblatt first announced the anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism policy, staffers also dissented internally. In an audio leak to Jewish Currents in 2022, Greenblatt admitted that he even knew that many of the children of ADL members and supporters were in JVP and SJP. But still, after October 7th, he tripled down on this dangerous posture. Last fall, the ADL and the Brandeis Center went to universities across the country calling on them to investigate, disband, or penalize pro-Palestinian groups under false charges of support for terror and anti-Semitism. Then, last year, Greenblatt supported the McCarthyite congressional hearings of university presidents and joined MAGA Republicans in calling for police to disband Gaza Solidarity encampments. It's impossible to fight for civil rights while pushing for the repression and erasure of one specific group. Working to ban Palestinian narratives is part of the same project as banning teaching about racism and colonialism. As long as the ADL supports a civil right carve-outs for Palestinians, it is aligned with and enabling the forces that want to exclude more and more groups from the protection of civil rights law. And now this coalition has the power of the federal government behind them, and they intend to use it. The plan is clear in Project Esther, a draconian vision by the Heritage Foundation to disband not just the Palestine movement, but the entire progressive movement infrastructure using false charges of anti-Semitism. And in Trump's executive order, which targets campus activists with threats of deportation. The ADL statement on this executive order had caveats about constitutionally protected speech, to be sure, but their applause for an administration that is openly embracing racist, segregationist ideologies gives away the game. The irony is that the same far-right political forces powering the Trump administration's return to power have been threatening Jews in this country for years. When Jewish Currents did an audit of the ADL's own data, they found that organized white nationalism was responsible for more anti-Semitic incidents in 2023 than every year since 2017, and that there's a clear correlation between anti-Semitism and anti-LGBT organizing. It's maddening that we're here, that an organization that's been entrusted for decades with protecting American Jews refuses to condemn the blatant anti-Semitism on display at Trump's rallies, and has downplayed Elon Musk's Nazi salute at the inauguration. It's tragic that Jewish organizations like the ADL have become part of the coalition, seeking to undermine the teaching of critical history and undermine decades of progress in civil rights in this country. We know that Jews will not be spared by this regressive Christian nationalist vision. We've already seen attempts to ban books on the Holocaust. We know that the very protections being dismantled right now are the very things that made us safe in this country in the first place. But facing this reality should also be a call to responsibility. This crisis of institutions is nationwide and global. No one is coming to save us. If we want institutions to represent us, we will have to grow our existing alternatives and to build new ones. and nothing can be fixed until it is faced.
So you just heard from Simone Zimmerman, who's speaking at the 2025 conference on the Jewish left. Again, that was a week before. It was very prophetic, really, because that was a week before the ADL, first of all, excused. It had already excused the Nazi salute that Elon Musk had done. Believe it or not, this is supposed to be a civil rights organization, and it was about to support Trump, stand shoulder to shoulder with Trump to dismantle free speech on campuses. And I wanted to tell you one thing before we go on to the next clip, is that the boycotts are working. Elon Musk, as you probably heard on Amy Goodman did a good report this morning on Democracy Now about the how devastated Tesla is financially right now. I mean, there is no place safe for Teslas right now, and that's why they're trying to make it illegal to boycott Tesla. The free fall, the financial free fall, the losses are in the hundreds of billions right now for Tesla, and no Tesla is safe out in public. Actually, I was at a Virginia parking lot, a vast one that's usually pockmarked with Teslas, this morning. I couldn't see a single one. I think people are starting to be afraid to even park it out in public because Teslas are getting keyed or worse, as we heard in the report this morning. So boycotts are working, and beyond this, that we have also the hitting them. You know, this is, it's really interesting that the word boycott came actually, was the last name of an Irish landlord, or rather a landlord that lived in Ireland, and was boycotted because he was such an evil landlord by the Irish. And it's really interesting that, you know, Trump himself is the son of a landlord, of such a landlord. I wanted to go into the next segment, and this segment, the speaker here is this is a very short segment, about 5 minutes or so, and I felt it was important to share, and this is speaker Emiya Gelman, who I saw her in person the other day at an event, and she's a professor at Sarah Lawrence College, and she's the founding director of the Institute for Critical Study of Zionism, which is doing excellent work on the topic. And she talks here about the Trump attack on free speech that's shored up by Zionist organizations like the ADL, who are threatening free speech again. So let's listen to Emiya, what she has to say on that topic.
What's happening right now is the Trump regime warming up for what it's going to be doing to all of us. So I wanted to give a little background on where it comes from, how it was queued up before the Trump regime even got here. Just to recap, we've seen the Trump regime now target students to be deported or put in jail for hate or the T word or un-American activities. We've seen them pull funding for any kind of research or education that deals with race or disability or queerness. We saw the Trump regime yank $400 million from Columbia in funding, public funds, on the claim that it did not do enough to protect Jewish students, by which the Trump administration means it didn't do enough to crack down on protest against the Israeli genocide, which is hilarious is not the right word. All of this, every bit of it, started before Trump. Over the past year, and even before the past year, it has been Zionist organizations making these demands to punish students, pull funding. The Anti-Defamation League and the Brandeis Center branded students with the T word. It's Netanyahu, who's a wanted war criminal, right? But Zionist organizations demanded that students be punished. The ADL, the Academic Engagement Network, and a ton of other Zionist organizations have also been attacking DEI, really attacking any effort to talk about who has power and who doesn't. before Trump, they were attacking ethnic studies education because they said that including Arab American and Palestinian stories made Jewish students feel blamed. And if that sounds familiar, that's because Zionists cribbed that line from white nationalists who said that teaching about slavery or critical race theory makes white kids feel blamed. Zionist organizations have been trying to use public funds to control political speech, not just at universities, but anything that touches public funds. So like hospitals, newspapers, businesses, FEMA disaster aid. Trump has just expanded on that. The takeaway is that Zionist organizations are racist, militarist, right-wing organizations. They might also be Jewish, right? But that is a side note. That doesn't tell us about their politics. Everything Trump is doing on college campuses right now, Zionist organizations have paved the way, they've handed him the tools, and they are now helping him do it. Zionist politics and right-wing politics are intrinsically linked, despite the contradictions that might seem to be there between anti-Semitic white nationalists and Jewish organizations who in theory should be opposing anti-Semitism. You can't fight the right without fighting Zionism.
That was spot on analysis by Maya Gelman, who's a professor at Sarah Lawrence College and a founding director of the Institute for Critical Study of Zionism. We could see that Zionists are at the heart of the damage that's happening. Not only have they just perpetuated this genocide that is rejected by the majority, the global majority, as we call the global South, this is something that's being confronted in every campus, and every campus right now should be organizing demonstrations and showing how their administrations are complicit with the Trump administration. Most of these campuses, these people pretend that they're progressives, they're liberal, etc., and that they hate Trump, but are completely taking orders and are complicit because they're, at the end of the day, they're crass careerists who bend with the wind. And so let's be that storm that goes the other way, because the way they're bending right now is completely to the right. And every university right now, as Mark Levine, the great scholar, had recommended, every university and college right now should have a group of 20 to 30 tenured professors that are protected. They're protected with the tenure, but it should be a group that is formed as an emergency response group, that they should come out with pots and pans and noisemakers and signs and bullhorns whenever ICE comes on campus. Not only is ICE coming on campus without the administration dealing with it, even the ones that are pretending to be sanctuary campuses, but there are people, right-wingers and white supremacists, that are coming on campus pretending they're ICE, and the administration is not doing anything about it. That's the state of what's happening. But colleges are the only place that where we have the opportunity for, you know, in 4 or 5 years, 4 to 6 years or more, to have independent thinkers and critical thinking, and to have the space to breathe and to talk about actual freedom before they get us on the rat race. And they should be protected. Otherwise, the world would be just producing more Trumps and Bidens. And lastly, I wanted to share with you this longer piece by our favorite source of information, which is the Electronic Intifada. In this one, in this segment, Noura Boros Friedman of the Electronic Intifada interviews activists in England that are disrupting the arms supply chain. And this is critical work right now that's ongoing. And people are taking great risks, as they must, because they know that that's what they would have been doing during the Holocaust. If you're taking a risk and you think you're going to be safe, you're fooling yourself. And these people are doing the hardest work. So let's listen to Nora Boris Friedman and her conversation with these brave activists.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. On February 24th, Palestine rights campaigners in Copenhagen, Denmark, protested at the headquarters of the transnational shipping company Maersk to demand that it stop delivering weapons to Israel. 20 activists were arrested and police violently cracked down on the protesters using tear gas and batons. Noted environmental and anti-war activist Greta Thunberg was amongst the protesters in Copenhagen.
We're currently outside Maersk, one of the biggest shipping companies in the world, that the last year, only the last year, has shipped thousands of tons of military equipment to Israel to arm them during their genocide in Gaza.
Maersk, for its part, claimed that the cargo at its Copenhagen port did not contain weapons or ammunition, but rather military-related equipment. And they added that they are derived from U.S. policy under the U.S.-Israeli Security Cooperation Program. The cargo has been screened and complies with applicable laws, Maersk said. Meanwhile, a new report by the Mask Off Maersk campaign, which is a project of the Palestinian Youth Movement, along with Progressive International and the American Friends Service Committee, released a brand new report. In late December, we had members of the Mask Off Maersk campaign on the live stream to talk about how Israel could not perpetrate its ongoing wars of extermination in Palestine without a global supply chain to import weapons and other material. Today, we're happy to welcome back two steering committee members of the campaign for an update on Spain's shipment of weapons parts to Israel. Welcome Aisha Nizar and Janine Hourani.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. And just to note, Aisha is based in Oakland, California. She's an organizer with the Bay Area chapter of the Palestinian Youth Movement and is a recent graduate from the Ethnic Studies Master's Program at San Francisco State University. Janine is an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement's chapter in Britain. She's a PhD candidate in Middle East politics at the University of Exeter. Thank you both again for being on with us. First off, your response to Maersk's claim that the activists in Copenhagen don't know what they're talking about and there's somehow a differentiation between arms and arms parts there. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, just to give some context around the protest camp. So as you mentioned, Nora, between February 21st and 26th, there was a cut ties with genocide protest camp in Copenhagen. On the 22nd and 23rd, there was scheduled programming at the camp. And then on the 24th, almost 1,000 people from across Europe shut down Maersk HQ in Copenhagen. And the demands of the protest camp and of the action were first for Maersk to stop all transportation of weapons and weapons components used by the Zionist entity of Israel. Second, for Maersk to terminate all contracts and investments that support war and genocide. And third, for the Danish state to implement a full weapons embargo on Israel. Now, as you mentioned, Maersk denies that it is transporting weapons and it claims that it is only carrying quote unquote military related equipment. And this is because Maersk distinguishes between goods with live ammunition and goods with no live ammunition. So while Maersk does not transport live munition to our knowledge, they transport rifle cups, they transport bullets, they transport military vehicles, including vehicles that rockets are launched on the back of. So they transport all of this military cargo, but not the live munition. And that's kind of why they continue to deny the fact that they are complicit in aiding and abetting war crimes. And I think, Aisha, when you speak about what's happening in terms of the Spanish government, we'll speak a bit more about, you know, how this is in breach of the Spanish arms embargo. From our perspective as the Palestinian youth movement, when we say arms embargo, we mean a complete and total embargo of all military goods destined for Israel. And we see this as the bare minimum. You know, what we actually want is a full and total embargo altogether of the Zionist entity, whether it's military goods, whether it's fruits and vegetables, whatever it is. And one way we've actually recently, as the PYM, expanded our demands is by releasing a research report that came in between the live that we had recently and in between the research report we've just released, that talked about Maersk's complicity in transporting settlement products. And so we know that, you know, Maersk is also complicit beyond just military cargo and also transporting settlement products. And what this really reveals to us is that it's basically near impossible for a corporation to be making profit from the genocide in Gaza without also making profit off the entire colonization of Palestine from the river to the sea. It's impossible, you know, to separate Gaza from the rest of Palestine. And that's why this campaign is more critical now than ever in this kind of quote unquote post-ceasefire moment to expose this complicity and to expose that, you know, we've witnessed 15 months of genocide. We've also witnessed almost 77 years of Zionist settler colonialism. And, you know, we as Palestinians and Arabs living in the imperial core have a responsibility to stop the supply chain of weapons being used to massacre our people. And we have an obligation beyond that to also isolate and confront Zionism in its totality and in its entirety. And so this campaign is really kind of a critical intervention in that and making a strategic and timely intervention in this kind of broader context that we currently find ourselves in. Mm.
Thanks, Janine. Aisha, did you want to comment on the action in Copenhagen as well?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't able to be in Copenhagen. Janine is based in Britain, and so she was able to actually be there and see what was happening on the ground. But it's really been amazing to see the way that this campaign has taken up. You know, when we actually said we want to enact a people's arms embargo, the logic behind that was that governments weren't responding to us. Like, we saw so many different cities, so many different states support a ceasefire, and yet we saw the Biden administration openly defy that. And then after so much pressure, he finally used the words ceasefire, but it was baseless because he was still shipping over millions of pounds worth of military cargo to the Zionist entity. And so we really wanted to push forward a people's arms embargo and actually target corporations that had a role in this. And seeing thousands of people from all across Europe, which is just a place that the PYM is now beginning to branch out into, be able to come to Copenhagen and put pressure on Maersk's headquarters, which we know is where Maersk actually cares about their reputation the most, was beautiful. I was really shocked and blown away by the fact that people are still showing up for Palestine this hard and willing to put their bodies on the line, even, you know, after a ceasefire has been enacted.
Yeah.
And just quickly also, like, the action also is historic in terms of the intervention that it's making. You know, for a very long time, we saw two ends of the spectrum. We saw A to B marches that are often kind of people feel like they are demobilizing, often require like liaising with the police. And on the other side of that, we saw Palestine Action taking direct action, you know, here in Britain, you know, smashing up weapons factories. And what the action in Copenhagen really signals is like a raising of the ceiling of what can be done at a mass level. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw mass action, almost 1,000 people take direct action. And that's only been made possible through, you know, the raising of the ceiling that has been made possible by groups like Palestine Action. And so I think this also signals like a new era of what can be mass, you know, what kinds of actions can actually be mass. So I think that's also like an important intervention that it makes in the broader movement.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about this new report that you published on military cargo flights from Spain to Israel. And with your research, along with the Progressive International and American Friends Service Committee, You found documented evidence that there have been 60,000 weapons parts shipped by air from Spain, much of which is against Spain's own embargo policy on arms. Can you talk about what kinds of weapons parts these are and how you were able to track these shipments?
Yeah, absolutely. So our report documented military cargo flights transporting over 60,000 weapons parts from Spain to Israel between January and November of 2024. These shipments consisted of key components for military operations. 45,000 shipments consisted of artillery weapons. You know, these are like rifles, rockets, grenade launchers, machine guns, and about 25,000 shipments consisted of a classification that they say is parts and accessories of revolvers and pistols. So we tracked these shipments using publicly available data from the Israeli Tax Authority. And so this records imports based on a standardized classification code for arms and ammunitions. And so we were able to basically cross-reference this data with flight tracking records. And then we identified a steady flow of military cargo flights departing from Zaragoza Air Base and then landing at Ben Gurion Airport in the Zionist entity. And so these airlines are the typical ones that we were tracking already. They're the ones that usually have contracts with the Department of Defense, and they're known for transporting military equipment. So it was, you know, like Challenge Air Cargo, National Air Cargo, Atlas Air. But I think I should mention that while, you know, some of these flights carried shipments explicitly categorized as weapons parts, what was really suspicious is that our data suggests that there is additional military or something that they call a dual use cargo that may also be transported, and that's going to require further investigation. And so what do I mean by that? I mean that there's the term dual use cargo refers to goods that have both a civilian and a military application. So in this context, you know, we were able to identify 60,000 shipments of explicitly categorized weapons parts, but there are still very likely other shipments that are going to fall outside this standard arms classification and could still very well support military operations.
And these components, where do they originate from? I mean, certainly, you know, Spain isn't manufacturing these. I could be wrong. Maybe Spain is. But I suspect that Spain is like an intermediary country for these weapons parts. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know, if we know anything about where these components originate from?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this actually gets at the logic of the Mask Off MERS campaign. So, you know, there's a couple different strategies for holding corporations and governments accountable for aiding this genocide. And really what we did was we started looking at the United States because we knew that the majority of weapons that were going to the Zionist entity was originating in the United States or was either being composed in the United States. So we were able to identify, you know, these weapons manufacturers and then look at specific lines of transportation that were classified by the Department of Defense and then see, you know, what would be the closest port that would, you know, be to this weapons manufacturer. From there, we were able to track through the Maritime Security Program that there are specific ships that can carry military cargo. And so we were then able to establish this routine. And that's how we've been able to check what the bill of ladens are and where they're originating from. Obviously, this is from across the world. Like, this isn't to say that they're not being originated in Spain, but the vast majority, I would say, was coming from the United States.
And how, you know, Spain is violating its own arms embargo policies by doing this. What political maneuvers have they engaged in to circumvent their own laws here? And can you talk about the Mask Off MERS campaign's efforts to hold Spanish authorities accountable for these weapons parts shipments that are against their own policies?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I will say that, you know, Spain has very strict national laws on their arms embargo. And we're in the process of determining how Spain is going to respond to these findings around the violations of military cargo being transported by air. But I want to be fair and say that there is a very progressive wing within the Spanish government that has been working to enact and uphold this arms embargo. We saw that explicitly when the Spanish government actually rejected the two Maersk ships from docking at their port based off of the research that we uncovered last year, which we haven't seen from, you know, many other countries that supposedly have an arms embargo. And so, you know, I would go as far to say that many, maybe even a majority of countries that actually have an arms embargo on Israel are having it violated with or without their knowledge. And that's because obviously the logistics sector is just as corrupt as, you know, weapons manufacturers or big oil. Like, people don't give them that that narrative, but they really are defying laws on a multitude of levels regularly. And so that's all to say that we have a really big focus on Spain right now. But I think that that's actually because that they're responding to our research and they're trying to actually institute a lot of the policies when these violations occur. And they're stuck within this NATO game. And so this attracts a lot of media attention. But I don't know if I would say that Spain is actually intentionally playing a bigger role in this genocide than, say, any other European country. Right. In fact, when we visited Spain, Podemos, which is like a left-wing party within the government, actually wanted to institute inspections on all ships under the maritime security program that were coming from the United States and docking in El Cáceres. We also saw Esquero Unido submitted a formal lawsuit to actually ensure that this arms embargo was being upheld and to push for these inspections. And at this point, this is when Maersk actually completely abandoned the El Cáceres port and now is taking all of their ships over to Tangier to then go to the Zionist entity. So we see that Spain has actually financially been hit by this and has been willing to incur that. And so, you know, we need to keep up the pressure on them. And we also need to extend this pressure out to other countries because Israel is stockpiling weapons for the next genocide. We know that an arms embargo is just as important now as it has been for the past 15 months. And so, I think that this is the way that we as like grassroots people, grassroots power can actually use our research and our skills to force the hand of some of these more progressive governments.
Yeah. Janine, let's talk about Francesca Albanese's office and what you know what the United Nations office that she's in charge of. She's the special rapporteur for human rights in Palestine. What her response has been, and how you've been working to try and get this on her radar.
Yeah, so in advance of the Human Rights Council's annual session, which is actually currently underway, we submitted, Francesca Albanese put out a call for submissions to her office, essentially for evidence of private corporations' complicity in Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people. And so what we did as a Palestinian youth movement was we submitted a report to her office on Maersk's complicity in various violations of international law. So this included things like war crimes, crimes against humanity, the crime of genocide, violations of international humanitarian law, and flagrant disregard of the advisory opinions issued by the World Court on the Occupation of Palestine. And so what our report did was that it highlighted Maersk's complicity in the genocide against Gaza, but also Maersk's complicity in ongoing land theft in the West Bank. You know, I mentioned the settlement report before. So when it comes to Gaza, what our report did was it detailed the specific supply lines that Maersk facilitates, and essentially highlights how these components are used in crimes against the Palestinian people. So, for example, Maersk ships part of the MK-84 bombs, which is a 2,000-pound unguided bomb that causes mass civilian casualties. And we connected our research into Maersk that the research team was doing and basically corroborated it with on-the-ground evidence from journalists that have been basically live streaming this genocide from Gaza. And in doing that, we were able to kind of show that Maersk has enabled Israel to commit this genocide and to deliberately target civilians in violation of the Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you know, we Maersk also ships the Oshkosh tactical vehicles, which if you guys saw those pictures and videos that went viral of Palestinian men blindfolded in the back of a Jeep, that is the Oshkosh tactical vehicle. These vehicles have allowed the Zionist entity of Israel to forcibly transfer the civilian population, which is again, is another violation of international humanitarian law. And so through the brave work of the journalists in Gaza, we've been able to kind of highlight Maersk's complicity and use that evidence to highlight Maersk's complicity. When it comes to Maersk's complicity in Zionist land theft in the West Bank, Maersk ships directly to West Bank settlements, and it has relationships with multiple corporations and companies that fortify the settlements. And this is in violation of several ICJ advisory opinions. It's in violation of human rights law, and it's in violation of our people's unalienable right to self-determination. And so what this report does is it kind of intervenes within a broader ecosystem of a growing legal consensus that Israel's actions, and not just its actions, but its very existence, is a violation of Palestinian people's right to self-determination. And, you know, we all have our criticisms of international law, but what this report does really is it uses the tool of international law to expose the hypocrisy of imperialist nations and confirm what we already all knew even before this genocide, which is that this idea of a, you know, quote unquote rules-based order is a farce. You know, we see that the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu, and Western nations have kind of twisted themselves into a knot to try and square their commitment to international law without actual with actually committing to a genocide. And even states who have a reputation for upholding international law, like Denmark, mm-hmm. and like Scandinavian countries that like to position themselves as these countries that are kind of human rights
bastions.
Yeah, that abide by human rights. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Haven't been able to enact even an ounce of accountability. And so, you know, as Palestinians, it was really important for us to be able to publish this report and to expose the fact that the so-called international community has failed our people. And you know, the failure of the world to intervene as tens, if not hundreds of thousands of our people have been massacred, have been starved, have been kidnapped, should be a damnation of liberal world order. And this report is a way to kind of really expose this hypocrisy. And so that's kind of why we wanted to publish this report, not because, you know, we think that the UN is going to be the liberator of Palestine, but because it enables us to kind of further expose this hypocrisy and also take the evidence that our people in Gaza have been producing to set the record straight and to show the world what's been happening over the last 15 months and actually amplify it on a global scale. And so the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine will always be our North Star. And even as we submit legal reports to the United Nations, they still remain to be our North Star in everything that we do. So that was something that was really important to us.
Mm. And it's also important to, you know, put these companies, whether it's Maersk or any other, you know, shipping company or arms manufacturer, to put them on notice, to you know, to highlight that people are watching and mm-hmm. people are reading the manifests and people are connecting the dots and people are writing reports and using, you know, their brains to develop these spreadsheets that really expose the underbelly of this war machine. And, you know, no matter how many impassioned, you know, statements, you know, world leaders post on Twitter or whatever, really what matters is their actions. And so I think that's really important. What kind of process is this now? You've submitted this report to the UN. You have these exposés on Spain. What happens with the report?
I mean, I can go and then Aisha, like, feel free to jump in. I mean, you know, Maersk is a logistics company, and so we can confront Maersk through intervening in the supply chain. And we've already done that. You know, Aisha spoke about how Maersk has been forced to reroute. They had at one point ships that were refused docking in Spain and were stranded in the Mediterranean and didn't really know where to go. They went to Morocco and they had, you know, dock workers refused to handle military cargo. And so, you know, we have already been intervening in the maritime strategy and in this like supply chain of weapons. And we've also, as you mentioned, Nora, you know, taken up these legal and diplomatic routes through, whether it's through the Spanish government, whether it's through Francesca Albanese's office, you know, we've used those tools that are available to us. But in addition to being a logistics company, Maersk is also a corporation, which means we can target it just how we can target any other big corporation. You know, at the end of the day, they're a commercial company. That's one of the reasons why we decided to choose Maersk as a target and not, you know, a logistics company that isn't commercial, that isn't publicly listed, for example. And so we have, you know, a plethora of tools available to us. We have the media, you know, popularizing Maersk through research, popularizing Maersk as a target, popularizing the wins of the campaign like we're doing here on this podcast. You know, mobilization is a really important strategy. We saw what has happened, you know, in on the 24th of February in Copenhagen. We also saw, you know, over the summer, our LA chapter mobilized against Maersk as well. So Maersk was unveiling its first carbon neutral ship, a methanol powered ship at the port of LA. And they had 2 days of programming. The first day was a press conference, which our chapter intervened in and organized like a popular protest around. And the second day they were meant to take members of the public onto this green ship. But because of the disruption on the first day, all the tours got canceled and the ship left the port of LA. And so we can see how popular mobilization, whether it's in Copenhagen, whether it's in LA, wherever we are in the world, is also kind of can create this popular pressure against Maersk. You know, we often say Maersk is everywhere, but so are we. And so we need to be thinking about ways we can confront them wherever they try, and whether it's greenwashing their image or whatever it is they're trying to do. Another avenue we have available to us is organizing labor. You know, workers in Morocco refuse to handle military cargo. And that is, you know, an example of worker-to-worker solidarity. We have seen trade unions put out statements endorsing this campaign and in solidarity with this campaign. We saw the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions put out a statement in the summer, basically saying that it highlighting the importance of intervening in the logistics sector and naming Maersk specifically. Maersk is publicly listed, so there's also a shareholder strategy we can take up. You know, Maersk has its AGM, its annual general meeting coming up on the 18th of March. I'll hand over to Aisha in a second to speak about this, but we've submitted two shareholder resolutions that have been added to the agenda. And so there's, you know, opportunities for us there to create public pressure around Maersk's AGM. And also, you know, the tried and tested tools of boycott and divestment, you know, whether it's city councils that have investments in Maersk or have ties with Maersk, whether it's universities, MIT has a huge partnership with Maersk, whether it's cultural institutions. So actually in Copenhagen, there's this foundation called the A.P. Møller Foundation, which is run by the same family that own Maersk. And they give philanthropic funding to arts and cultural institutions across Denmark. We've identified at least 12 of them. And so now we're thinking about how we can work with arts and cultural workers in Denmark to get these cultural institutions to cut ties with Maersk. So there really is so many opportunities for us to intervene and to pressure Maersk, whether it's through the maritime strategy, whether it's legal, shareholder mobilization, divestment, sanction, boycott. There's all of these tools available to us. And so we really need to be getting creative. And we really need to be thinking about, you know, what pressure points exist in the places that we're organizing and how can we, you know, make the most and, you know, pull those levers in the places that we're organizing. And this is particularly important in this moment because we've seen over 15 months of people taking to the streets for Palestine. And, you know, at one point in London, we saw 1 million people take to the streets for Palestine. And campaigns like this one are a really great way of taking that street energy into like long-term targeted organizing work. And so that's why we really think that these diverse tactics are really important to employ so we can take this energy that exists in our movement that we've been able to grow over the last 15 months and channel it into, you know, enforcing a people's arms embargo from below truly. Maybe I'll hand over to you, Aisha, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, Janine, I think you really articulated like all of the different strategies, all of the different parts of the kit. I mean, Nora, you could probably tell that we're definitely like steering like in the weeds of everything when you get
I love it.
Research or the campaign strategy. But I think like all in all, to summarize, like, you know, we're a youth movement, we're grassroots, we're volunteer, you know, and so we approach this and we've had a lot of lessons that we've learned since launching this campaign. And really, like, you know, right now what we're thinking about is how are we able to disseminate this campaign into the masses? Because we actually want this to be a people's arms embargo. And so how are we able to use our research, our tools? We were literally, you know, using school databases to like come up with this research. You know, all of this is, again, none of us were trained in any sort of research methodology. And but through that, we were able to then create these reports, submit to the United Nations. You know, we're now being listed as a BDS target. And also, we still want to make sure that we uphold the political agenda that we have as the PYM and as the Mask Off MERS campaign, which is, you know, a liberated Palestine from the river to the sea. And right now, what's really important is that we're actually forwarding the arms embargo angle as well. Yeah. So, you know, I think that we're going to see a multitude of divestment campaigns that are going to come up on a local level now that it's being listed as a BDS target. And we need to make sure that we're also able to continue pushing for an arms embargo. You know, Maersk, if they divest from the settlements, that's not going to end our campaign.
Right. And there is an International Day of Action coming up. Can you talk a little bit about that and what and how people can plug in? You know, if people don't live near a port or they don't, you know how to get involved with something like a Mask Off Maersk campaign, what are the steps?
Yeah, so you can, if you want to get involved in the campaign more intimately, you know, we do have a network. And you can follow us, you can get in contact with us from the Mask Off MERSK website. It's maskoffmersk.com. And you can submit, we have a form on there, and then we'll get in contact with you. We can talk through different strategies and different ways that you can take up in your locale. On March 18th, we will be having a day of action. The specifics of that will be announced online. So you can follow us at the Palestinian Youth Movement. Or at the Mask Off MERSK on Instagram, and we will be announcing all of the details about this day of action soon.
That's great. You know, finally, before we end, if you both could maybe talk about how we can assess the growth of the Mask Off MERSK campaign around the world and how, you know, really these kinds of actions can inspire other, you know, grassroots campaigns. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, when you were talking about the workers at the port in Tangier, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, for years, there's been really incredible, steady solidarity by the International Longshore Workers Union.
We just heard an interview with Palestinian youth movement activists that are doing incredible work and essential work in terms of intercepting the arms supply lines to Israel. As was mentioned there, Israel, if you're not aware of this, Israel hasn't had enough massacring of people. And since the US still stands by it and will give it all the weapons it needs to massacre as many men, women, and children and elderly and destroy as many hospitals and schools as possible, that they are getting ready for a second genocide. That's why cutting off this main vein is really necessary to stop the bloodshed that's happening. As you know, probably you might have heard, if you're paying attention, that they've cut off electricity to the Gaza Strip during Ramadan, and of course cut off aid. You know, the joke is that they cut off food because it is Ramadan, to allow people to fast, but we know what's going on. So as you've heard, there's going to be a day of action to look out for on March 18th. And if you follow Palestinian Youth Movement, the national Instagram page, you can find out what you can do in your own area in terms of protests and demonstrations, etc. This is Aylin Amin signing off. See you next Wednesday.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Manhattan federal judge Jesse Furman today ordered Columbia University student Mahmoud Khalil to remain detained in Louisiana for now, despite his lawyer's petition to have him returned to New York. The judge ordered more briefs from Khalil's attorneys and from the government. The judge also entered an order that the pro-Palestinian student activist be permitted privileged calls with his lawyers, who said they had not been able to speak with him since his transfer more than 1,000 miles away. Khalil helped lead Columbia University's pro-Palestinian protests last year and played a crucial role in mediation between school administrators and student protesters opposed to the school's failure to divest from Israel amid the ongoing atrocities in Palestine. He was arrested Saturday at his apartment by ICE agents, who told him that his student visa was being revoked. He was then transferred to an ICE processing center in Louisiana. The arrest is part of President Trump's pledge to crack down on pro-Palestinian protesters on college campuses, and in a post on social media, Trump described the arrest as, quote, the first of many to come, close quote. In other news, the U.S. Department of Education last night said it would cut nearly 50% of its workforce. Over 1,300 positions will be cut, and roughly another 600 employees accepted voluntary resignations or retired over the last 2 months. Education Secretary Linda McMahon told Fox News that mass layoffs are the first step toward President Trump's plans for a total shutdown of the agency, which only Congress can enact. In reaction to the firings, Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, issued this statement, quote, Trump and Elon Musk have aimed their wrecking ball at public schools and the futures of the 50 million students in rural, suburban, and urban communities across America by dismantling public education to pay for tax handouts for billionaires, close quote. She added, quote, students get one shot at an education. Educators won't be silent as anti-public education politicians try to steal opportunities from our students, our families, and our communities, close quote. And the House voted yesterday to pass a short-term federal funding bill aimed at preventing a government shutdown ahead of a Friday deadline at midnight. The bill increases defense spending and funding for veterans' health care while decreasing non-defense spending below 2024 levels. It also includes more funding for immigration and customs enforcement. The bill passed the House virtually along party lines, with all Republicans except Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky voting for it, and all Democrats except Representative Jared Golden of Maine voting against it. It still needs to pass the Senate, however, where it will need the support of at least 7 Democrats to overcome the 60-vote filibuster threshold. The bill contains no new limits to prevent Elon Musk, Doge, and agency heads from firing federal workers or canceling federal grants and contracts already approved by Congress. It would also force D.C. officials to rapidly cut $1.1 billion in local government spending over the next 6 months by effectively canceling the district's active 2020.